You're listening to Women's Magazine on KPFA 94.1 FM and online at kpfa.org. I'm Kate Raphael.
Hope into practice. Jewish women choosing justice despite our fears opens with a story. And the story goes like this. I meet a guy in a bar that's cute. He asks, "You're Jewish? Wow, you don't look Jewish. You don't act Jewish." And he says it in this tone that sounds like he's complimenting me. And I say nothing. I say nothing, which combined with a flirty smile translates to thank you. That story by Vanessa Hidari is, quote, pretty close to her own story, says Penny Rosenwasser, author of this new book on anti-Semitism, anti-racism, and liberatory healing. Penny Rosenwasser, activist, teacher, writer, musician, rabble-rouser, and former KPFA host, joins me now in studio. Penny, congratulations on this book, which I know is the product of many years of hard work.
Oh, yeah. Thanks, Kate.
And welcome back to our KPFA airwaves. So this book is first and foremost, though not certainly not last, about identifying and challenging anti-Semitism. And it's primarily about the experience of Jewish women in the U.S. Is anti-Semitism in the U.S. really such a problem now that it's worth devoting a book to its impact?
Great question. I definitely think it's alive and kicking. It's, you know, it's not nearly what it was in the 30s and 40s, which was the high point of anti-Semitism. I mean, some, you know, big examples then were the fact that there was not enough of a consensus in this country to get the U.S. into the war to try to save the Jews from being slaughtered in the camps. You know, there's known anti-Semitism in the State Department, and I think FDR didn't want to go against the popular consensus, and it's certainly nothing like that now. But I think the point of the book is really the internalized anti-Semitism, how these harsh messages that have been passed down through our families, because as we know, it was pretty bad a while back. I mean, 70 years ago, a third of the Jewish people in the world were slaughtered, two-thirds in Europe, and then periodically, intermittently, for thousands of years, you know, the pogroms, the crusades, the inquisitions, things like that. And that takes a toll on people. And I mean, just like, you know, slavery has taken a toll on black people and other groups that have been enslaved, native people. I think certainly we don't have a market on it. But I wanted to focus the book really on how we've been affected by it, because I noticed it in myself. I mean, there's a lot of stories in there about my own, the harm it did and how I've been really recovering from that. And I've noticed it in a lot of Jewish women around me. This all came up for me in my graduate, when I was in a doctoral program working on racism. And I was going to do my dissertation on helping white people transform our racism. And I was in a study group. I was very blessed to be in a study group with four African-American women. We were called Four Dreads and a Jew. And they noticed that I wasn't sharing much of my own story. And they said, if you want to be an ally to us, you have to first feel good about who you are. Because otherwise I would be trying to, which I think is really a common way that as white people often our racism comes out, is trying to get folks of color to say good things to us so we'll feel good about ourselves, you know, as opposed to doing the work to feel good about ourselves.
So come to anti-racism from a place of pride in who we are,
yes,
as opposed to,
yes,
trying to somehow make up for something we feel is deficient in ourselves.
Exactly. And so in really working to uncover, you know, I was working with other white people to really look back at, you know, where do we come from? Who are we? And that's when all this internalized anti-Semitism came up. And I was shocked. It was not what I was expecting. For me, it was very much about growing up very assimilated in Virginia in the 50s. Still identified as a Jew. I went to Sunday school, I got confirmed, you know, we had the menorah in the window. But again, that was when people would say, gee, Penny, you don't look Jewish. I would say, thank you. And it's what I thought I was supposed to say. And when I remembered that in my 30s, I went, my God. I mean, that I think is an indicator of what it was like growing up in this very white, Protestant, middle class, Christian suburb of Washington, D.C. in Northern Virginia in the 50s. And I, you know, I was born 4 years after the last death march left Auschwitz. So I think there was a lot in the air that I absorbed, but it was invisible to see. I mean, I didn't encounter overt anti-Semitism that I can remember till I was in college. And I wanted to pledge a sorority. And I found out through my roommate that one of the sororities I wanted to pledge was debating whether to admit me or not because I was Jewish. And I was like, whoa.
Just before I ask a little more about that, I just want to clarify, many people say that anti-Semitism refers to discrimination against Jews and Arabs. And I've even heard some people say that it's more accurately applied only to Arabs at this point. But you use it to refer only in your book to anti-Jewishness, and you couple it with the term anti-Arabism. So why did you make those choices?
Yeah, because in the late 1870s, Wilhelm Marr in Germany coined the term anti-Semitism specifically he was specifically speaking against Jews, you know, and that was part of the thinking at that time. And then it was also happening in this country, I think, in the early 1900s, that Jews were biologically inferior. And that's where that term came from, anti-Semitism. Of course, Jews are not the only Semitic people.
And what are some of the scars that you carry from that sort of subtle and maybe a little less subtle anti-Semitism that you were talking about a minute ago?
As a kid, when we had to wear these little ID bracelets, and mine said Hebrew, and I really wanted it to say Protestant. You know, I really didn't like that. I think the deepest piece is growing up so assimilated. And again, my parents were visibly Jewish. There was nothing in my family that was against that, but I think because in the air all around me, it was not a good thing to be a Jew. And I think I absorbed that and internalized a lot of self-disgust and disconnection from my people. So I always felt like there was kind of a hole in my heart and like I didn't know what my story was. And I think people could feel that around me. And that has really changed. I feel like, oh, I know now where I come from and who my people are. And I feel good about that and proud about that. And of course, heartbroken about what some of my people are doing, especially, you know, in Israel and in some places in this country and other places. But, you know, there's all kinds of people doing horrible things.
And you don't just share your own stories in this book, but you actually have a group of women that you sort of follow through a set of processes. Who are some of those women and how did you all come together?
Yeah, so I used this method. It's called it's action inquiry, and it's called cooperative inquiry. And it's a method that is very democratic. I felt like it's very in sync with my feminism. It's very egalitarian. It valorizes using the emotions. And you come to your findings as a group. When I came across this in my doctoral work, I went, this feels perfect. It felt very similar to, you know, like a feminist consciousness raising group. We did have certain, you know, guidelines that we needed to pay attention to. So I wrote letters to friends. Of course, the internet was just kind of happening then, so that wasn't as big a deal. I put ads in the Jewish papers. I went to synagogues and put notes on the boards. I went to conferences. I'd meet people. I'd ask them. People would refer me. But I was asking for a commitment of people willing to spend like a day a month. And, you know, a lot of us as Jewish women activists are busy. So there were people that would have liked to but couldn't commit that time. And in what I asked for women who were soulful, who identified as somewhat progressive. I wanted to be ethnically diverse. I wish it had been more so, but two of the women were part Mizrahi.
Which means what?
Which means their ancestry was from Iraq. We were an age range from, I think, 25 to 50. Grew up all over the country from Boulder and New York and Kentucky and the Bay Area and Canada, Montreal. Different levels of education. You know, some people had not gone to college. Many had. Several had master's degrees. Pretty good class differential in terms of working class, middle and upper middle, and different Jewish practices, people who had bat mitzvahs, people who didn't connect to that at all. So I felt like that was a good, and probably at least half of us were lesbian. I can't remember exactly, but there were 10 women in the group total, 6 who were there the entire time. Some people, you know, for one reason or another ended up leaving, but it was very, it was life-changing.
And why did you feel like it was important to focus on women for this book? And you have a little section that was near and dear to my heart because it's talking about the sort of special role that stereotypes about Jewish women play in the U.S. imagination, I think both for Jews and non-Jews, which is something that I've done a lot of exploration about myself. So I was hoping you could talk a little about how sexism and anti-Semitism come together in our culture.
I think they're very closely bound. I mean, one is, as we started sharing our stories together, which is a lot of what we did, we shared our stories And in that process, even though we came from very different backgrounds, we found a lot of commonality. And the big aha for that was realizing we don't have these individual pathologies. We're not neurotic. We're actually responding to a system of anti-Semitism that has targeted us as Jews in a Christian culture. And one of the things that one of the women came up with is was that we felt like we were either too much or not enough. And the not enough would be not Christian enough. You know, we're too loud. We're too dark. We're too hairy. We're too smelly. We're too strong. We're too aggressive. We're too difficult. We're too needy. We're too emotional. One of the healing strategies is reframing that. I'm not loud. I'm passionate.
This is Women's Magazine on KPFA 94.1 FM and online at kpfa.org. I'm Kate Raphael, and I'm talking with Penny Rosenwasser, author of the new book, Hope into Practice, Jewish Women Choosing Justice Despite Our Fears.
You know, one of the stereotypes of Jews is, oh, that we're so powerful and that we're too powerful. And so sometimes as activists, and I think I give different examples, I think there's one from Andrea Dworkin, for example, feeling like we have to be quiet so that we won't be targeted as being loud and pushy. And what that does is it limits our activism. It weakens our strong voice. And one of my really basic assumptions about working through internalized oppression, including the internalized sexism and internalized anti-Semitism, is that this stuff, these voices that are in our head, Sally Kempton says something like, beware the enemy who has outposts in your head. These outposts in our head, there's a way that they, you know, the chatter goes on and tells us ways that make us feel like there's something wrong with us. And that really keeps us from having the biggest possible lives we can have and being the most effective activists.
Some people say, and I feel like I hear this more and more lately, in left circles, but the Jews really do have extraordinary power in U.S. society. So if people hate us for that, they don't hate us for what we are, but for what we do. And especially that relates to the undue influence that the Israel lobby has on U.S. politics towards the Middle East. How would you respond to that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad you brought it up. There's a whole chapter about that. It was by far the hardest chapter for me to write. I edited it many times because it's complicated. But I feel like we have to speak to it. The majority of Jews in this country are affluent, which is not to deny that there certainly are Jews who are poor, and a small percentage who are extremely wealthy. We have a level of privilege that I don't think Jews have had, you know, up until this point in our history. And that's a blessing. That's a good thing, that anti-Semitism is not what it used to be in this country. But I think what happens is the stereotype is of Jewish power, Jewish prominence is not the same as Jewish control. And I think prominence in the media, prominence in Hollywood, and let's look at why. Because the way anti-Semitism unfolded in this country, there were a lot of jobs Jews weren't allowed to have. Even making movies, starting in New York, Thomas Edison was very against letting Jews into that elite profession. And that's why a lot of the moguls moved to the West Coast and started making movies there, because they got squeezed out by Thomas Edison on the East Coast.
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting. I didn't know that.
I didn't either. I mean, just learning about that, the more elite jobs in the media are held by Jews. And that's way out of proportion to our percentage in the population, which hovers around 2%. But what that means is 75% of the jobs are not held by Jews, and most of them are held by Christians, and many of them are held by white men. In terms of the Israel lobby, I mean, wow, that was a hard part to write, because I think it is complicated. Netanyahu comes and gets 29 standing ovations from Congress. This was in the last couple of years. So that's where the Israel lobby has had the most influence, is in Congress. And AIPAC certainly has a ton of influence and is very intimidating and likes to be, because it's a lobby that really wants the Israeli right-wing Israeli policies to persevere. Oh, and another part, of course, is that a lot of it is funded by Christian Zionists. But I think the reason that the Israel lobby has the power and influence it does is because a lot of its goals and strategy are very much in line with what the strategy is of U.S. imperialism that's been consistent in countries all over the world for quite a long time. when you have the same goals and strategies as whoever's in power in this country, then that's going to give you more power. And I think the way anti-Semitism operates is it's convenient to blame Jews, and that takes the attention away from the class system.
You've devoted a lot of your life in the last 20 years or so to the struggle for justice in Palestine. And for a lot of Jews, and certainly for me, and I think for you, that commitment didn't come that easily. How did you get involved in the Palestine issue?
Wow. It's actually pretty connected to my Jewishness. I think I hadn't mentioned this part before, but this happened in Oakland when I had moved here around 1982, and I walked into a women's bookstore, which no longer is there, and saw the book Nice Jewish Girls. And for the first time in my life, again, because not feeling great about being Jewish, not feeling very connected, for the first time in my life, I felt like I connected to these stories by Jewish lesbians. And some of the people that I was most connected to at that time, Jewish lesbians, very strongly supported the Israeli government and the right-wing government. This was in the early 80s. And I was so happy to finally feel good about being Jewish. I just didn't want to deal with, I didn't know much about what was going on, but I just didn't want to deal with it. And I said, well, you know, but what about the fact that the Israelis are shooting Palestinian children? They said, oh, well, the children are throwing Molotov cocktails. I went, okay, I didn't want to deal with it. My lover at the time begged me to go to a performance by the Dance Brigade. And it was a play, and Nina Fichter, whose memory is dear to me, Nina passed years ago, was acting out a letter written by a Jewish nurse who was taking care of children dying after being massacred at Sabra and Shatila. I mean, the children, some had been massacred, some were still alive. And I just sat there and started crying. It came through my heart, and I thought, I don't know what's going on there, but I have to deal with what's going on there because that's been my life as a social justice activist. You know, I'd been working, supporting the Sandinistas in Nicaragua. I was working in Oakland around supporting women with AIDS. I mean, I had to figure out, I had to do something. I felt like I had to figure out how to hold both feeling good about being a Jew and facing whatever it was the Israeli government was doing. I went over there. I was a programmer at KPFA. I brought my microphone. I brought my tape recorder. I got names of Palestinians, and I was especially focused on women, women, Palestinian women, as well as Israeli, Jewish Israeli women that were activists. And I went around and spent several weeks, and I stayed in refugee camps. I was in Gaza for a week. This was 1989, 1990, and it changed my life. And it just, I was blown away, first of all, with the Palestinians at how, when I would be in their homes, it felt so familiar to me. I mean, first of all, the hospitality, the warmth, the food, the ideas, the discussion. And most of these were folks who did speak English. But even if they didn't, the kids often did, you know. And then with the Jewish Israeli women, their earnestness and their fierceness and their determination. You know, I remember this march of 5,000 of them through the streets of Jerusalem. And then there were 20,000 of us. We did a Hands Around Jerusalem that was so powerful, and it was for peace. And then I remember when the young Israeli soldiers started firing water cannons on us, and it was green water, so it would stain us so they could see who I w- and then started beating Palestinians. Facing that, it was a shock to me. It was heartbreaking and really difficult. And what saved me was connecting with other Jewish women around who were sharing the same experience. And some of those women have become lifelong friends. And I felt like I came back and I thought, I have to let people know the humanity of these people. These are not the terrorists that we hear about. And that's when I ended up spending hours and hours and hours at this radio station. I had a full-time job, but I would spend weekends and evenings editing those interviews and maybe 20 different half-hour interviews of Palestinian. That's what became my first book, Voices from a Promised Land, Palestinian and Israeli Peace Activists Speak Their Hearts. I have to actually thank Bob Baldock, who heard the interviews on the radio and found a publisher. And they came to me and said, we want to publish your book, Curbstone Press, which was a nonprofit. But KPFA played a big role in being a place that I could get those on the air. And then I distributed them through the Middle East Children's Alliance.
You now work.
Yes.
For many years. So when you talk about Jewish women choosing justice, yeah, how much of that for you has to do with Palestine and the struggle for a just peace in Israel and Palestine. You know, do you feel like every Jew has a responsibility to work on this issue? Or is it okay if people say, well, this just isn't what seems most important to me? As you say, lots of people are doing bad things. White Americans stole land from Native Americans, but we're not all working on saving Native American land from mining interests. You know, so what about that?
It's a great question. I could talk for an hour about that.
We'll talk for 5-10 minutes about it.
I love what different Jewish groups are doing domestically in this country around, you know, standing up for immigration reform or against police brutality or any of food justice, things like that. But in Israel, Jews are in power. And of course, as we know, the Israeli government is totally backed by this government financially in terms of a lot of different kinds of support. So it's not, I don't want to just say it's just Israel doing this. It gets U.S. support. But I feel a responsibility. I feel very connected to Jews all over the world. I feel a responsibility for what the Israeli government is doing in my name to Palestinian people. It breaks my heart. I could not look in the mirror in the morning every day if I did not feel like I was doing as much as I can at any moment to try to end the occupation, to try to win human rights and equality for Palestinians. My rabbi at Kehillah Synagogue, Rabbi David J. Cooper, has said he thinks it is the civil rights struggle of the 21st century. And I love that he said that. The book is very much focused on what I'd call, there's a chapter that's probably the heart of the book called Taking Egypt Out of the Jews. And it's from a line in the Passover Haggadah that says, it's not enough to take the Jews out of Egypt, but we had to take Egypt out of the Jews. And I'm not talking there about Mizrahi Jews, Egyptian Jews. I'm talking about the dynamic that when you've been victimized, and this is true, I think it's true around people who've been endured incest or domestic violence, people have been traumatized, you internalize that trauma, and if you don't work through it, it's very possible to project it onto other people. And in the domestic violence movement, they call that hurt people, hurt people. I took the title of the book actually from Irina Klepfitch, who is a friend and colleague of mine. She's a wonderful lesbian Yiddish women's studies scholar at Barnard, and she was 4 years old when the Warsaw Ghetto uprising happened. Her father helped lead the uprising and died in the uprising, and she and her mother escaped. And she said, even when we are afraid, my Jewish fears remind me that I have not left the tribe. I need to convince others of what I have to convince myself again and again, that we must choose justice despite our fears, that our fears are real, rooted in history, but they cannot control us or stop us from making just choices. There's actually a chapter in the book called Liberatory Healing, where I think there's different modalities, whether it's meditation or breath work or co-counseling or using art or music or yoga, because I think these feelings rest in our bodies and we have to figure out how to recover from this kind of toxin that's not our fault that it's in us, but it's in us. And part of the healing, I think, is really building community with other Jewish women. It's just like what we learned in second wave feminism and the personal is political, those consciousness-raising groups and realizing how common our experiences are and that the problems were totally a response to systemic oppression and building closeness. So I think, you know, building closeness with other Jewish women is incredibly healing. And it's not necessarily easy because we have our stuff triggers each other. And one of the things I think we say about internalized oppression is if you don't think you have it, notice what really triggers you in another Jewish woman. I mean, I could say an example was I would be and still do get really triggered by Jewish women, especially who are really overtly competitive. And I used to say, oh, you know, I'm not competitive. I don't care. You know, ugh, why is that person doing that? And at one point I realized, Penny, you're so triggered by her because you have that exact stuff in you. You try to hide it.
So, of course, not all of our listeners are Jewish women. There are going to be men. There are going to be non-Jews. Does this book have something for them as well?
Oh, absolutely. I'm so glad you asked. And I really work to, I mean, it's in terms of internalized oppression, any marginalized group has that, whether as queer or trans or people of color, folks working class, raised poor, people with disabilities, older folks, younger folks. And I think a core piece of internalized depression is feeling, being made to feel like there's something wrong with us. And I think that theme runs through the book, is having those feelings. And it's also very focused on activism. So I really think anyone who is kind of working to make the world a better place in whatever way, I would hope that this would give some good, you know, ways to think about things, some new ideas, some analysis, because there's definitely the first few chapters are very analytically focused. I think the middle chapters are more about the internalized depression, more psychologically focused. And then the last third of it is about our recovery and our healing.
Well, if you would like to learn more about some of these practices and get a chance to take a look at the book, maybe get one for yourself, Penny will be celebrating the release of Hope Into Practice, Jewish Women Choosing Justice Despite Our Fears, on Monday, November 18th. That's next Monday at 7 p.m. at Kehillah Synagogue, 1300 Grand Avenue in Oakland. You'll hear more about the book, engage in lively discussion, enjoy some wonderful music, and even sample taste treats, Jewish treats, I assume.
Not necessarily, but, you know, it's not to be essentialist, but I think a lot of us as Jews enjoy food, and so I couldn't do an event without that.
Penny Rosenwasser is the author of two previous books, Voices from a Promised Land, Palestinian and Israeli Peace Activists Speak Their Heart, and Visionary Voices, Women on Power, Conversations with Shamans, Activists, Teachers, Artists, and Healers. And both of those are based on interviews that first aired on this radio station, KPFA, back in the days when the Women's Department had something like 19 hours a week of women's programming. You can find out how to order those books, as well as Hope Into Practice, and get lots of other resources and information on Penny's website, pennyrosenwasser.com. And we'll link it to our blog, kpfawomensmag.blogspot.com.